share with you some impressions of the last World Congress, which was held in Antwerp in March this year. How can I start the movie? Is that a special button?
Where is the mouse? The
sabotage.
Again?
What did you learn at this World Congress?
Well, we had some great beer, Belgian beer. We had an opening reception with a Catch the Diamond, because Antwerp is a diamond city. So it was really, really lovely. No, I was happy, and I understood a lot of Christians talk. I just heard the word intra-abdominal drus. So I'm very happy, because it seems that in the previous days this topic has been discussed, or people were thinking about it. Maybe just go ahead and shoot some questions with regard to abdominal pressure. Who measures intra-abdominal pressure? Give it a vote. Oh, this is great, so I can stop. I don't need to give my talk. Who does not believe anything about intra-abdominal pressure? Who thinks that it's just a useless parameter? Please vote.
The surgeon that was here on Thursday.
Okay. That's a good question. Are there any surgeons in the room? Okay. We can speak freely.
There are some.
He woke up again. So I skip the slides with the video, and I directly go to the slides.
Let's hope it works. So it's a report of the Third World Congress. Who am I? Well, I am the ICU director in our institution. I am also founding president of the World Society. It's a big name. It's funny, if you're only five people in one society, you can become the president. I work together with some companies. I don't think it's a shame, but I just want to share this with you. This is my hospital. So it's the video. It's working with you. That's the video.
It's working.
So it's an aggregate of hospitals. It has 2,600 acute beds. While you can skip the video, it's not necessary, really. It's,
No.
Maybe at the end, we'll see.
At the end, so.
Yeah. It's here. And the hospital is constituted in round towers, and on the left you can see our patient population. Sometimes it's an unknown man, woman after a drug overdose, and with very speaking tattoos, as you can see on the right-hand side. So we have four ICUs, a medical surgical, we have a burn unit, and a mixed tattoo. We also have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. This is some pictures of the old round wards. This is when I was a resident on call. So it was quite nice during the night, the nurses in the middle, the patients in an inner and outer circle. Some things, they do change. As you can see on this slide, this is me 15 years ago when I was a resident in that same hospital. Some things don't change in life, like marriages are of old times and old places, and this is in fact a patient with a COPD, tracheostomy, who got married in our medical ICU. So what about the WCACS? It's the World Congress on Abdominal Compartment Syndrome. And you might not know, but already in 2001, there was a first World Congress in Australia with 50 participants. 2004 was again in beautiful Noosa in Australia. And there we had about 150 participants. It was very nice. It was in December, so it was full summer in Australia. And we had some nice talks, poster discussions on the whole. 84 accepted abstracts. So now let's come to the WCACS 2007. And this is some flavor of the opening ceremony. And while we were a bit mixed up, the abdomen is also called the belly in English, so we had a belly dancer. This is the industry. This is the opening ceremony with the Catch the Diamond in a glass of champagne. That was very nice. This is a cloth I received from two doctors from Uzbekistan who were too poor to pay the entrance, but they gave me this very nice suit. Got a lot of attention. This is the WSAX executive, so now we are more than five, as you can see, we are six, with some guys all over. Michael Sukru in the middle, he will be the president for the next meeting. So you can see the presidents, Michael, the current, Mark Cheatham from the States will be the next one. So the facts and figures of this Congress is that there was a tremendous increase in the scientific content with regard to faculty, lectures, abstracts, and also the number of participants steadily increased up to almost 450. So I think that the sky is the limit. We heard this, 100% measures us. There are no non-believers in this room. So why? Why intra-abdominal pressure? Well, have you ever seen a patient swollen up after massive fluid resuscitation? Well, we probably all have. And we've seen these patients going into kidney failure, needing renal replacement therapy. And we also have seen patients with multiple organ failure that eventually died. But did we know the abdominal pressure of these patients? Probably we did not. However, already in 1873, Wendt said it all. He said that the higher the abdominal pressure, the less the secretion of urine. And he was not the only one. If you look at the timeline, numerous publications have been published already in the 19th century. Jules Marie, he measured pressures in horses long before we used to measure pressures in men, and he stated that the effects produced in the thorax by respiration are inverse to the pressures present in the abdomen. In the middle, you have Paul Baird, and it's on the left-hand side, sorry, it's Paul Baird in the middle, Claude Bernard. And in his laboratory, Paul Baird measured pressures through tubes inserted in the trachea and rectum, and he also ascribed elevations of intra-abdominal pressure with the descent of the diaphragm. This is some tracings of the original publications from Mosso and Pellacani, who were the first to measure bladder pressures with this very difficult machine. In the years after, in Germany, in Bern is not Germany, it's Switzerland, in Switzerland, some nice studies were done in pigs where they increased intra-abdominal pressure and saw the detrimental effects on cardiac output and kidney function. Afterwards, over the years, very incentive techniques have been devised to decompress the abdomen, and especially in patients with alcoholic liver cirrhosis, hydropic abdomens, and tense ascites, as you can see here. A Dutch surgeon, Nicolas Turp, he invented a special device for stage peritoneal fluid evacuation. And he warned against too rapid drainage as an ischemia reperfusion insult causing sudden death. This is Haven Emerson, who published a landmark paper in 1911. He was writing the first review on intra-abdominal pressure, and he also concipiated a technique for measuring intra-abdominal pressure in different parts of the abdomen, and he found that the pressure was equal regardless of the place where you measure it. So he suggested that maybe the abdomen follows the law of Pascal. This is just some flavor of what has been said before. So where do we go from here? Should we reinvent again what has been said in the 19th and 20th century? That's why we created, after lots of Australian good wine, the WSAX, which is this famous world society. And our mission, we call it, is to foster, educate, promote research on abdominal compartment syndrome, and thereby maybe improve survival of these patients, bringing together physicians, nurses from all over the world. And this is the first publication of the society. It's in intensive care. It's the consensus definition statement, and I would like to briefly go over it with regard to abdominal pressure. Normal pressure is around 5 to 7 millimeters of mercury in adults, like CVP. We say that it's elevated if it's above 12 millimeters of mercury, and we suggest the following grading. A compartment syndrome is defined if the pressure is above 20 and there is new onset organ dysfunction, either or not in combination with a low abdominal perfusion pressure below 60 millimeters of mercury. Abdominal compartment syndrome is different whether it originates from the abdomen or outside, like we have for primary and secondary ARDS. So primary compartment syndrome originates from the abdomen, that's easy. A secondary originates outside it, it's like in burn patient, capillary leak, septic shock, massive resuscitation, and a recurrent ACS, it's like a tertiary peritonitis, it is an ongoing chronic more kind of disease. So the second publications after the definitions were some recommendations. They were based on the grade system going from strong recommendation 1A to weak suggestion level 2C. This is the publication. You can download this from the WSACS website. I'm not going into detail. So what did I learn in Antwerp? That was a question. So I'm briefly go over it with regard to monitoring. The society advocates that we should screen every patient in the ICU on possible risk factors for intra-abdominal hypertension. And whenever there is two or more of these risk factors, so if you have a ventilated patient who has a trauma, massive resuscitation, we should screen at least for baseline intra-abdominal pressure. So as Samuel Shem said, if you don't take a temperature, you can find a fever. So we need to measure the pressure. You can do it either intermittently, like I worked 5 years in Brussels, so you know the mannequin piss, so you can use the bladder. Different techniques have been described, but sometimes it gets leaky, kinky, you can have an over-underestimation of the real intra-abdominal pressure. Other techniques have been developed, like the 40 nanometer, which uses the height of the urine column, which is the gold standard of any pressure. Or other companies, like an American company, created a kind of a valve. Those interested, there has been a review on all these different types of techniques. What is important that if you go for the bladder, you need to do some priming to avoid that there is an air bubble and you get a damp signal. But yesterday I was discussing, and in a hospital sometimes they instill 100 mLs. And you can see if you would instill 100 mL, you would have a bladder pressure of 17 compared to 12, which would be the real intra-abdominal pressure. So you can increase bladder volume, you get a pressure on the detrusor muscle, and you have an overestimation of the real abdominal pressure. So the society says that you should just rinse the bladder with a small amount at max 20 millimeters of saline. You can also go for continuous abdominal pressure measurement, and then you have also continuous abdominal perfusion pressure measurements. This can be done by different techniques like piezo-resistive membranes, which has been validated by Alexander Shaftrup, or other techniques like the Spiegelberg on the left, and the Belgian company now has launched the Simon, which works via a normal nasogastric probe with a balloon, and then you can have a continuous tracing on the bedside monitor. Just with regard whether you use a balloon filled technique, so air filled versus fluid filled with a priming solution, in these two techniques who are fluid filled, in the stomach in green and in the bladder in blue, you can see that head of bed elevation increases intra-abdominal pressure. And the increase is about from 8 to 14, so it's a 6 millimeters of mercury increase. So that's important. We advocate to measure it in the supine position, but I know that for prevention for ventilator-associated pneumonia, you need to put the patient in head of bed. So there will be some research on that. Here you can see that when you compare fluid versus air fill technique, so in a balloon measurement, you don't have the issue, the problem of the hydrostatic fluid column. And here you can see that the Spiegelberg balloon in green, regardless of the head of bed position, gives a more stable abdominal pressure measurement. Which one is the correct one? I cannot tell at this moment. So, always measure supine. Head of bed elevates intra-abdominal pressure, you need to know that, but not if it's already high, then it won't make much of a difference. The zero reference point was set to go for the symphysis pubis, but now we advocate to use the mid-axillary line at the level of the iliac crest. Use a small volume for priming. So just pick a technique, perfect it, and use it, and measure it if there are risk factors. So what about children? Are children any different from adults? And there was a nice paper from a doctor from California who found that basically a child is not a small adult. So bladder priming in children should be based on body weight, so 1 ml per kilo with a maximum of 20 ml. Increased abdominal pressure is very well known in children after correction of omphalocele. Normal AIP is lower, and we say that it's increased at a pressure above 9, and abdominal compartment syndrome at pressures of 15. Also, because mean arterial pressure is lower in children, abdominal perfusion pressure has a lower critical threshold, probably around 50, but we need more data. What about the ICU? Well, in general, we should say monitor the risk factors, start the measurement. I cannot repeat it more and more. And try not to over-resuscitate. Why is that? Well, fluid resuscitation, when less, may become more. We all know the four fluids of life. We start with a bottle and we end with a Baxter bag, probably. Why could fluids be detrimental? This is a nice study in burn patients where you can see in light those with abdominal compartment syndrome, well, they received much more intravenous fluids per 24 hours. And they did a study comparing hypertonic lactated saline compared with ringer lactate, so a hyper-oncotic solution, and they found that they need to give less fluids, but urine output was the same. And they also found that at 24 and 48 hours in red in the hyper-oncotic group, abdominal pressure was lower and abdominal perfusion pressure was much higher. So the problem with massive fluid resuscitation is that at a certain point it may become futile. So we're giving fluids which the patient does not need, but sometimes there is no choice in the initial phase of a necrotizing fasciitis in a hemorrhagic shock. But at the end, these patients will get third spacing, ascites, bowel edema, skin edema, and they will probably end up with a secondary ARDS on the ventilator. And if you do not stop, the intestine will swell, would get hypoperfused, and can become necrotic. So the question is, if you have these kind of bellies in your ICU, when do I stop giving more fluids? Well, I think that giving less fluids might be better in some patients. Why? Well, we did a study in 256 patients, and we found that survivors on the left side had a negative fluid balance by day 3 and a much lower cumulative fluid balance. And this was also found by the SOAP investigators, who found that a positive fluid balance was an independent predictor for bad outcome. So it seems that there is a correlation between a capillary leak, you give loads of fluids, you get intra-abdominal hypertension, and you get subsequent organ dysfunction and maybe exitus of your patients. So it's the eternal discussion between colloids and crystalloids or the dry and happy lungs. So what about ICU management? I take it into 5 steps. So on admission, important, can it repeat more, check for possible risk factors. You can see them at the website. If more than one, start doing a baseline abdominal pressure measurement. As in the book, if you don't take a temperature, you can't find a fever, so start with one measurement. Prevention of iatrogenic causes of increased abdominal pressure, well, we need to evacuate nasogastric contents, sedate the patient, maybe we need to paralyze the patient, act on fluid balance, avoid tight bandages. So maybe sometimes delivery of medical care is to do as much nothing as possible. So when AIP is rising, there will be a pressure on the diaphragm, intrathoracic pressure will increase, and animal and human studies have shown that an average transmission from the abdomen to the thorax is about 50%. So what about the effect of intra-abdominal pressure on respiratory mechanics? This can be divided into an effect of intra-abdominal hypertension on ventilator-induced lung injury, and here you can see that abdominal compartment syndrome after 60 and 90 minutes, increased interleukin 6 neutrophils and TNF-alpha in the lungs of the study animals. What about lung distension? Well, the famous slide from Luciano Gattinoni's group is that on the right-hand side, if you have an increased intra-abdominal pressure, you will have an increased elastance of the chest wall or a decreased compliance of the chest wall. On the left-hand side, you can see without curarization, on the right-hand side, with curarization. And that's the problem. If you curarize a patient with a high abdominal pressure, you will get dorsobasal atelectasis. So it's important to open up the lung and keep it open. Just an example to calculate this abdominothoracic index of transmission at the bedside is abdominal compression with a Velcro belt. You can see an increase in abdominal pressure, an increase in the CVP, and then you can calculate in this particular patient the transmission was 60%. If the abdominal pressure is increased, you get this rightward shift of the respiratory PV curves, as in this study by a group of Gattinoni. We looked at that in patients with acute lung injury and mostly in the patients with secondary acute lung injury, so with a high abdominal pressure, there was a good correlation between the lower inflection point on the PV curves and intra-abdominal pressure. Because there was also good correlation between abdominal pressure and pleural pressure in patients on mechanical ventilation. If you look at total respiratory system PV loops, inspiratory, expiratory, you see that by increasing abdominal pressure, you get a rightward shift and a downward shift of the PV loop. Basically, because esophageal pressures were increased, if you subtract, then you see that the lung is not sick in case of increased abdominal pressure. The problem is in the chest wall. So what about recruitment of patients with high abdominal pressure? Recruitment is an ongoing maneuver. But if intra-abdominal pressure is increased, the opening pressure are much higher. So you don't recruit the lung with a 40 by 40 maneuver, but probably more with something like a 40 plus half the AIP, taking into account the transmission of 50%. For lung protection, these patients, they will have plateau pressure far above the limit of 30 centimeters of water. So you can allow or you can target towards a transmural plateau pressure, which is the plateau pressure measured by the machine minus half the intra-abdominal pressure. Otherwise, it becomes impossible to ventilate these patients. You will only have tidal volumes of 300 mLs. So what about the PEEP? Well, again, in intra-abdominal hypertension, the closing pressures are much higher than if abdominal pressure is normal. So here, as a rule of thumb, we can say that the best PEEP to keep the lung open after recruitment is to set it at the level of the intra-abdominal pressure to counteract the upward shift of the diaphragm. What about pulmonary edema? If you have a lung with oleic acid in a pig, you will have edema in the basal regions of the lung. But if you would then increase intra-abdominal pressure, it's like you squeeze all the fluid, all the water into the whole lung from top to base. That you can see here, oleic acid, you put a pressure of 40, you can recruit the lung. But if intra-abdominal pressure is increased, you see an upward shift of the diaphragm, and at the same pressure of 40, you only recruit half of the lung. So the opening pressure at the bottom is not 40, but probably 40 minus the AIP and only 20. So you need higher opening pressures. In this study by the group of Tuns and Schachtrup, you can see that extravascular lung water is increasing in intra-abdominal hypertension. And this was shown especially in the debintant regions at the pressure of 30. There was a lot of edema and necrosis. So in summary, too low a PEEP will increase ventilator-induced lung injury, especially if abdominal pressure is increased. Classical PEEP is too low. Best PEEP could be said to counteract the AIP. Maximal plateau pressures, you have an extra space, let's say, some room for recruitment. Maybe because we saw that with curarization, it's the dorsal basal regions or in atelectasis, what we do if abdominal pressure is 18, 20, we set the PEEP at 20, but we apply weights on the chest. Another possibility could be to put the patient in prone position, but then you need to be sure that the abdomen is free. So we need higher opening pressures. Studies have shown that if you ventilate a patient, it will increase intra-abdominal pressure. If intra-abdominal pressure increases, you will have a higher shunt fraction. PEEP per se only moderately increases abdominal pressure. And the combination of a capillary leak, a positive fluid balance, and a high abdominal pressure has an exponential impact on extravascular lung water. So what about the heart? I call it the polycompartment syndrome. You have the interactions between different compartments, and you can see a tracing of the CVP in red, abdominal pressure in light blue, and the intracranial pressure. And this is the baseline tracing with the correct CVP of around 12 measured and expiratory. If you would now apply a Velcro belt to this postoperative patient, you can see that intra-abdominal pressure increased up to 17, and the CVP up to 20. So the corrected CVP could be calculated as the one you measure at end expiration minus half the AIP, which then becomes our baseline CVP. By doing so, you can calculate the index of transmission either at end expiration or end inspiration, and the transmission from abdomen to thorax was around 50-60%. But as you can see, to the brain, where there is no, where there is only limited space at increases of volume, transmission was almost 100%. Recently, was a very nice study from the group of Lederman, who looked at the effect of forced expiration in patients with COPD on abdominal muscle contraction. So in relaxed breathing, the CVP at end expiration was 13. But then this patient underwent forced expiration. You see an increase in the intra-abdominal pressure with 19, and you see an increase in the CVP of 13. So they suggest to calculate the corrected CVP based on the one you measure, minus the delta of the AIP, and they found a very good correlation. Another issue is that functional hemodynamic parameters like stroke volume variation, pulse pressure variation, because of the effect of increasing abdominal pressure, you see an increase in these functional hemodynamic parameters because of a kind of auto transfusion effect from the venous capacitance vessels. You can have a kind of a delta up effect, which is more pronounced if you would use systolic pressure variation and less if you would use pulse pressure variation. So intra-abdominal pressure increases our filling pressure, so we need to calculate transmural filling pressure. It has an impact on how we're going to handle with the surviving sepsis campaign guidelines, but there they advocate to use a CVP of 8 to 12. We should maybe use more volumetric indices of preload, like global end-diastolic volume or right ventricle end-diastolic volume, and be aware that intra-abdominal hypertension can increase functional hemodynamics. Also, maybe we need to think about resuscitation our patients towards abdominal perfusion pressure, which is MAP minus AIP, or a filtration gradient of the kidneys, which is MAP minus twice the AIP, meaning that the kidneys are one of the first organs to fail if abdominal pressure is increasing. So what about the brain? Briefly, because I think that Emanuela Keller talked about it. What is the effect of a pneumoperitoneum on cerebral perfusion pressure? You can see a drop in CPP and increase in intracranial pressure. If you then add an inflated epidural balloon, you can see that ICP further increases. And if you have the combination of a pneumoperitoneum with an intracranial mass effect, it's a kind of an exponential increase of the ICP and a drop in the CPP. In this study, Bloomfield, we give sizatracurium, and you can see that AIP dropped from 17 to 9 and ICP from 15 to 10. So maybe patients that we think they have intracranial hypertension, maybe the problem is within the abdomen. What about the kidneys? Well, I discussed and I thought that the kidneys are especially vulnerable because of this cumulative effect of intra-abdominal pressure surrounding the tubuli. And in this study with patients with respiratory failure, we looked at outcome differences, and you can see here that in 258 patients, that although intra-abdominal pressure was not significantly different, abdominal perfusion pressure in non-survivors by day 2 was significantly lower, suggesting that abdominal perfusion pressure might be a better surrogate endpoint. I skip these. I think now there is a video coming and there is maybe another problem. Yes, he doesn't like my videos. Okay.
You talk and we switch them.
Well, this just some videos that Cam Inche showed in Antwerp on flow in microvilli in normal and septic shock conditions, and then also in conditions of increased intra-abdominal pressure. And it's very nice to see if intra-abdominal pressure increases, you see that the flow is sluggering and eventually there is no longer flow. And if you decrease abdominal pressure, you again see a very nice flow that you can see there, but you cannot. Okay. So try.
I touched that behind.
It's amazing how Bill Gates is the most rich, the richest man on earth, and what he makes sometimes does not work. Maybe just the one with the. Yes, you go to the septic on the right. So in a septic patient, you can see that there is no flow, there is sometimes even backwards flow, so there is sluggering flow. You can go to the next slide. Next. Okay, and now you activate the one, okay. Now it's the one on the right. But it seems that it's missing a codec or something. Okay. But I can tell you, if you increase abdominal pressure, you see the same as in the septic picture, which is an absence of flow. No, no problem. But now I cannot...
You can. It should work.
Okay. What about anesthetic considerations? Well, I think anesthetists know very well the issue of a high body mass index, a high abdominal pressure, and a low forced residual capacity, and also the higher the intra-abdominal pressure, the higher the chest wall elastance. And this was seen in patients with extrapulmonary ARDS. They have higher abdominal pressure. So the two are mostly linked. You have a primary abdominal compartment syndrome with a secondary ARDS. What about surgical decompression? So I think before asking the surgeon, I think we need to optimize medical treatments for increased abdominal pressure. So there is no good body cavity that cannot be reached, and if there is some fluids or air, we should drain it, we should put nasogastric tubes, rectal tubes, we should avoid tight sutures, avoid Velcro belts, and we could use curarization. In this study, you can see that curarizing decreased abdominal pressure from 17 to 13. In this patient, you can see after you give sizatracurium, a high end-tidal CO2 fighting with the ventilator. This is abdominal pressure, this is end-tidal CO2, and also in this patient, a sustained increase in intra-abdominal pressure. You curarize, you give a perfusion pump, and you see that intra-abdominal pressure normalizes, end-tidal CO2 normalizes. Some fancy things, like putting a negative shell on the abdomen, has been studied in human and pigs. The surgeon, he left, the surgeon is no longer here. But I think it's important that we discuss the patient with the surgeon. And I think that we should open the abdomen. If the pressure is at 25, there is no discussion, if the value is accurate, of course. If the pressure is above 20 with new and ongoing and deteriorating organ failure, then I think we should not postpone surgery. But we should always treat the underlying cause. And it's not always a laparotomy, but sometimes you can decrease abdominal pressure without opening the abdomen, like subcutaneous linea alba, fasciotomy, or lumbotomy in case of pancreatitis, as was shown by a Spanish colleague. If there are collections, you need not go directly into the abdomen, but via a lumbotomy, you can drain the collection. So what about temporary closure? Well, most of the patients we are able to close within the first week. And I'm not going into detail, but there is a PAC module on abdominal perforums where you can see these different types of temporary closures. Most of the time we go for a vacuum-assisted facial closure with the KCI technique. Okay, I'm going to skip the videos. Now it's too much video, I don't know. Okay. Just to end, a worst case scenario. A patient we had in our ICU, 32 years, a necrotizing fascia transferred for hyperbaric oxygen therapy. This is the patient. She has a low mean arterial pressure, a high CVP, high abdominal pressure, abdominal perfusion pressure of only 35, poor oxygenation, lactate of sick, the patient is in shock. So we take her to the OR and we found that there was still necrosis and a leak of the anastomosis, and she went for surgery. And after that, she went into the hyperbaric oxygen chamber for the necrotizing fasciitis and then back into the ICU. So the first treatment was just moist gauze. So we left the abdomen open, but no vacuum closure. Then she went back to the operating theater. You can see on the left that abdominal pressure decreased till 10. This is the Bogota bag in the middle there. And then at day two, we put the vac treatment, which took about three sets of abdominal dressings because it was so big, the laparostoma. And this is the evolution of the patient. So at day 26, she was already back on the normal ward, and the intra-abdominal pressure nicely decreased. This patient went, came to the World Congress, and she gave a testimony. She now, I think she lost 70 kilos after her bariatric surgery. What did we do? Well, we put some tubes here and there. We sedated the patient, we curarized her. We gave some albumin, furosemide. She also got dialysis, ultrafiltration. Body positioning is important. So not in the upright position, but the whole bed in the anti-Trendelenburg position. Then finally she was decompressed, but by all times we tried to keep abdominal pressure as low as possible and perfusion pressure as high as possible. If you have an aggregate of studies, the effect of decompression basically shows that you can decrease intra-abdominal pressure, but you will increase organ function and urine output increases after decompression. So to take home, I think that abdominal hypertension, it does exist. In the literature, it's about 25% of abdominal hypertension in mixed ICU populations, and about 5% of our patients will have abdominal compartment syndrome. But you won't know if you do not measure the intra-abdominal pressure. Intra-abdominal hypertension is a cause of multiple organ failure, and I think we need to resuscitate, we need to change our way of thinking, resuscitate towards abdominal perfusion pressure and use volumetric indices of preload instead of parametric ones like the CVP and the wedge. If you're going to use the CVP, then try to calculate a transmural CVP by subtracting half the RP. We need to ventilate these patients differently because they are different from primary ERDS patients. The best PEEP could be set as a rule of thumb to counteract the effect of AIP. We can allow a higher plateau pressure. It has a high morbidity and mortality, but it can be treated. Thank you for your attention.